Well, a split show for you tonight. We've got Peter Ward this hour, and we're going to take your phone calls with Peter as we talk about rising sea levels, creating aliens on Earth, and some genetic manipulation as well. So get ready for your calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Peter, do you have any concerns at all that some kind of a organism, virus from another planet could hit here? Of course, I think it already has been here, but could hit here and create a disaster?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's already happened. And because my research partner in many things, the guy I go to Antarctica with, the guy who discovered Snowball Earth, Joe Kirschvick at Caltech, has shown to my satisfaction that there's no way that Earth life evolved on the Earth, but it had to have come from Mars. We talked in the last hour about this idea that you need ribose. Ribose comes from a desert. There were no deserts on the early Earth. The early Earth was entirely water-covered. Joe was part of the team that studied the Allen Hills meteorite, and he showed quite convincingly that those little chains of magnetites are probably bacterial in origin. He's also studied panspermia, the possibility of life going from planet to planet, and showed that all you need to be is about a third of an inch under the cover of a rock, and cosmic rays don't get you. So spores of viruses, spores of bacteria certainly can do this. And finally, one of my PhD students is studying the last bastion of life unstudied, the high atmosphere. He sucks stratospheric air out of the air using U-2 spy planes and identifies the various microbes. And we have on the west coast of the U.S., you too, George, we have Chinese dust falling all over us. And the biggest scary part about this is that we could be picking up smallpox and other viruses from China that dump right on us.
Amazing. What about the radioactivity from Japan?
Oh, it got us. It got us.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I ought to do a whole show on the upper atmosphere life, because it's fascinating what's happening up there, how much life is up there, and how with deforestation in Asia, more and more of Asian microbes are falling all over we on the West Coast.
Okay, let's take some calls here, Peter. This hour with you is going to blaze by, and then I want to ask you a question, so tuck it behind your head about why Earth was laden with so much water, where it all came from. Let's go to Kevin in Cleveland, Ohio, first-time caller. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Welcome to the program, my friend. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, George. I was going to ask Peter who the leading researcher in the world today that's, you know, trying to put it all together, you know, the aliens and the stuff from the comets and all of that, you know, the work that Whitley Strieber's doing and the late John Mack, and, you know, just who was the world's leading researcher on trying to bring all this together?
Well, I bet you don't have to go very much farther than your radio to be with a person who probably knows as much as anybody, and that's George. George
right.
has had the access to everybody on this show, including all the various scientists. I put my money on him. If you want to, just as a great summary of the knowledge out there, it's going to be George.
And what you can do, Kevin, and here's a little secret for everybody. Just go to our search engine at coasttocoastam.com. Up there, type in topics that you're looking for, and it will spit out all kinds of information, websites, guests, you name it. And it's all cataloged for you that way. Peter, where did we get so much water? How did it come to this planet? How did it start?
Well, that's the best question of all, and it's still really unknown. The party line is it came from comets, that we just got blasted by Oort cloud comets. This heavy bombardment that was from 4.2 to 3.8 billion years ago was all the leftover flotsam and jetsam. And as you go past Jupiter, we have something called the snow line. And out there, there's a lot more water than there is in here. I mean, look at Europa. It's got a 100-mile thick ocean. Come on, there's so much water out there. Well, a lot of the comets are just big ice balls, and we were hit over and over and over. Don Brownlee.
By big comets. They'd have to be big.
Oh, there's some of these were the size of Texas, and we have these things. Balls of ice the size of Texas coming in.
Okay, well, if a ball of ice the size of Texas, in terms of its entire, you know, ball-looking size, that would be pretty big. How much water would that be, though, if it hit in an area where part of the ocean is? How many comets would have to fill up all the oceans we've got?
Well, we're talking about a way you can think about it is the equivalent of Earth ocean. So we have one Earth ocean now, and early in the process of the Earth coming together with all the heat, we lost maybe a whole Earth ocean, but we may have gained another whole Earth ocean just from the comets. So we've lost a lot, but we've gained a lot more from the comets. But here's what's scary, George. People have done some really complex computer simulations and have run scenarios of our solar system forming over and over and over. And only about 1 out of 10 of the scenarios do you get planets in the sort of the order they are that we have them, the small inner planets and the large outer planets. It could be all dispersed in all different order. And getting water as much as we had is a low probability. I mean, it all goes back. We are a rare earth.
Yeah, we sure are. Okay, more calls. Dana in Manchester, New Hampshire, east of the Rockies. Hi, Dana.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay, Dana, thank you.
First time caller. I was thinking about what most mainstream scientists have been saying about the Earth and Earth changes and everything, and I don't know. The thing about science is they don't look at the other aspects of it. Like, what about Lindsay Williams and when he talks to the elite about what's coming up?
Mm-hmm.
The government moving the CIA to Denver. What's up with that? What about the New World Map Edgar Cayce predicted where the East Coast, West Coast, Cali, Midwest, et cetera, they're all going to be underwater? I think it was a guy a month ago on Coast to Coast, said about Project Pegasus.
Yes.
When he went ahead at 2013 that he saw Washington, D.C. under 6 feet of water.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, stuff like that.
Peter, let's get your take on this. The predictions of Edgar Cayce, the late American prophet, his map of what North America would look like was staggering. There's no California. Some of the East Coast is gone. Is it possible?
Well, here's what's possible. If we melt all of Antarctica and all of Greenland, then yes. What you lose the entire Great Valley. The entire world looks totally different. How do you melt all that ice? There's just no conceivable way to do that in less than a few thousand years. Even if we heat the planet through any sort of warming, any way it happens, it's going to happen, though, because we know that the sun keeps getting bigger and bigger, and there is that inevitability that this ice on this planet will leave. So I can absolutely tell you without any reserve at all that map will happen. The question is when.
Well, that's scary, because when it happens, we're talking about a disaster of biblical proportions, Peter.
Well, hopefully we have enough time to engineer with it and to deal with it. Look, the Dutch have taken a very good approach to these things. Their point is, why do you worry about cities being flooded and then you have to keep moving them and moving them again? They're starting to build giant floating blocks of buildings that will just ride with it. And although that horrible movie Waterworld was a joke, in some ways, we really can see where coastal communities just start being portable. I mean, we'll have centuries and centuries of sea level rise, and people will get really tired of building a city and then moving it over and over and over. Why not make them portable?
That's a good point. We've got Richard in Phoenix, Arizona, and he's up with us. Hi, Richard.
Hey, George. You know, you make the show a success. You're just, I can tell what we hear is what we get. You're a genuine guy. I really enjoy the show.
Thank you, Rich.
I heard a commercial just before he got back on this brother Michael Diamond. I'd like to see him back. I enjoyed his show.
Yeah, you know, that sparked my interest when I heard his commercial here he is. So, yeah, we're going to give him a call.
Great. And so a comment and a question here. By the way, lactose intolerant, I just did a quick Google search, and USA Today, September 1509, states conservatively 40% of the world is lactose intolerant. I don't know how you came up with 98. I'm with George on that. I'm also with George on the lack of coincidences, and this comment's just based on going towards your viewpoint on creation and evolution. And, you know, I think the scientific method would mandate and dictate that scientists like yourself take a look at, you know, the Shroud of Turin, Our Lady of Fatima, the Virgin of Guadalupe in Mexico. Look at near-death experiences. Look at what geneticists are saying. They analyze the DNA sequence, and they see a message from God in there. And I think it's just it's gotten to the point that maybe good scientists like yourself, unless you're tenured, they're just afraid to come out and really say what they really believe, and they're doing this research just to, you know, just to get funding and go along with the system. And I got to give Coast to Coast credit, because if you listen to just a tenth of the show, you'd hear, you know, there's just so many guests that come on and talk about how creation is possible. I'd like to get your comment on that, and thank you for a great show, both of you.
Okay, Rich.
Hey, well, thanks for the comment on lactose intolerant. If I'm that far off, I was really under the impression that most of the world can deal with it. I'll check on that. But secondly, I think one of the reasons that Coast to Coast is a great show, and one of the reasons that I have, I don't know, 10 or 12 times taken 2 or 3 hours out of my life, I don't charge a penny to do this, is that Coast to Coast does bring on scientists. You have such a diversity of views here that you need science and you need the other side. And that's what Coast to Coast does. It's a community where we can get both sides.
Well, it is. And it's important, Peter. You know, even though I may believe in God, I want to hear why somebody else doesn't. And I want to hear their mindset. I want them to tell me why they think this planet evolved without a God influence. It may never change my mind. And in that case, it never will. But I still think it's important for people to hear those kind of views. And just because we put a guest on, and I'm not talking about you specifically, if we put a guest on that has views that are totally opposite how I may feel or somebody else may feel, doesn't mean that we agree with that. And I think some people, when they send in emails, go, oh, my God, you had that guy and he attacked so-and-so or he did this. Doesn't mean we agree with it, but it's important that everybody gets their other views. Like we might have the scientist on Monday. We may have the metaphysical guy on Tuesday. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, that's the beauty of the show. I mean, this is, again, why I agree to come on. I absolutely agree. It's like a nice, it's what a university should be. It's open-minded.
And you don't get it. You don't get badgered. You don't get attacked.
Nope.
You know, it's not one of those kind of programs where the host wants to interject himself more than you. I want to hear about you. I want your views. People don't need me on all the time.
But one of the, just to the final comment to the last listener, but there's also, I sense, and it's scary to me, more than not, there is a sense of hostility towards scientists. I mean, we get this tinge of we don't trust them, and the guy just said they're just doing it for the fun.
I think the reason for that is I think people would be happier with scientists who are a little bit more open-minded, you know, rather, because a lot of scientists, Peter, are pretty rigid, you know, and you know, everything to them is cut and dry. And I think what you sense sometimes are people who just want scientists to just be a little more flexible, a little more open to the possibilities that these other things could exist.
Well, again, scientists are people, and people, we all have our foibles. And just what you have to understand is everybody in science is doing the best that they know how to do. Sometimes that's not very good at all, but it's not a conscious effort. It's just that it's so overwhelming to have to try to figure out what nature does and how it works that people do get conservative. They get overawed by it, I think is the point. But just, I mean, cut a scientist a break. And my complaint with scientists is that so few of us actually take the trouble to try to speak to the public. If you want to indict scientists for that, and I do indict my scientists, brethren, for that, not enough of us attempt to go on a radio show or write a book or tell the world what we do with their tax money.
Do your views differ from most of your other mainstream scientists out there?
Oh, boy, I'll tell you. I mean, I was lucky enough to win the biggest award a university gives, and I just sat up there and I said, you know, the reason we have such poor science literacy in America is because of people like us. When we tenure somebody, it is not for their outreach. It is simply for their scientific papers. But that's the problem. You have to reward somebody who writes a book. You have to reward somebody who writes a Scientific American. You know, I've written 17 books. Not a single one goes on my professional bibliography. They're not part of my life at the University of Washington. This is like my hobby. And yet this is what I think the most important thing I will have done in my life. So it's just, there's a, the culture has to change at the big universities.
Steven, truck driving in Wyoming, first time caller. Steven, you're up with us. Hi.
Hey, how's it going, George?
Good.
All right. I got a kind of a two-part question. I'll try and make it really quick. The first part, I was wondering what your guests maybe thought of being what we know about Mars now and how life more than likely existed there before, of it making its way, you know, whatever happened to Mars, maybe an impact from an asteroid or whatever, destroyed life, and as a result of that impact, the bacteria making its way to Earth, and maybe that would be the origin of life.
Okay, what do you think of that first, Peter? Let's let you answer that one.
That's exactly the theory that my friend Joe Kirschfink gave at the Carl Sagan Memorial Lecture at the biggest scientific meeting of geologists and astronomers a couple of years ago. The only difference is that we don't think a big meteorite destroyed life on Mars. Rather, Mars was just too small to keep its atmosphere. It's a really small planet. It had a very shallow ocean, and it's so cold, very quickly it lost the gases it needed. It just didn't have the gravity to hold on to stuff. Mars life would have gone through this real quick cycle of origin, making it the bacteria, some of those bacteria getting blasted onto Earth. Because again, if you need a desert, and 3.5 billion years ago, the only desert you could find was Mars. It was perfect for the formation of life, according to these new ideas we have about ribose. So Mars, we are Martians, as far as I'm concerned.
No doubt. What's your other question there, Stephen?
Well, it kind of deals with what you guys did, the exchange you just had. I've been listening for a couple of years, and it seems like there's more people from the Christian perspective on the show as far as your Christian background. I was wondering if there was any possibility of ever having maybe someone from like an atheist perspective on your show, like maybe Richard Dawkins or Steven Weinberg.
Oh, sure. We've had some people like that on. Not as many, obviously, because there aren't as many. But, yes, we have had that.
Okay. One last comment, I'll take the result off the air. As far as the Mars thing, do you think it's far-fetched of it maybe being intentional, like as a means to sustain their species, there was intelligent life on Mars, and they seen this maybe devastation coming and send something off towards the Earth?
That's always possible. Peter, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd like to believe so, but at least from what we think the timetable on Mars was, if we compare how long it took to go from a bacterium to a human on Earth, we don't think Mars had the time to get to intelligence. But again, this is using Earth as sort of a metric. But then again, if we are Martians, they would have had the same sort of rate of change as we do on Earth. So we really, you think that Mars, between, say, 4 and 3.5 billion years ago, that would have been the reign of life on Mars. After 3.5 billion years ago, there's no way it would have dried up into that desert. It's been a desert a long time. So you only have 500 million years to go from the first life to intelligence. Maybe it could happen. I don't think so. I don't think they ever got to animals. I don't think they went beyond bacteria. Darn it. I really want Edgar Rice Burroughs to be correct. Barsoom.
You never know. We're going to come back in just a moment. Peter Ward, our guest. We will take some final stories and final calls with him in just a moment. Split show. Nurse Joyce Riley joins us later. She's going to talk about it, a very sad story that seems to be coming out of Afghanistan and Iraq when our soldiers come back here. But we'll be back in a moment. We'll take more calls with Peter Ward on Coast to Coast AM. Well, stay gathered around the radio. Next hour, Nurse Joyce Riley joins us with some important news about our returning soldiers. When we return in a moment, we'll take final calls with Peter Ward on flooding and aliens on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, back with Peter Ward, your calls as well. What do you think about Titan, Saturn's moon Titan?
That's my favorite place we should go to. I think we ought to even skip Mars to go to Titan. Titan is an easy place to get to compared to Mars because you've got an atmosphere. You can glide in. You don't have to have these parachutes.
Methane lakes there, Peter.
Oh, it's the coolest stuff. I wrote a book in 1996. No, I don't know, whatever, sometime about life as we don't know it. And I got so entranced by the possibility of Titan life. It's so cold there that carbon acts in really strange ways, and so does silicon. And you can make long-chain silicons that sort of mimic long-chain carbons. That's what most of our life is made of. And these things are theoretically, you could put together some really interesting new types of life forms. So, yeah, I'm really high on Titan is the place we ought to go to.
What's it doing with methane lakes? How'd that get there?
Well, you've got all the a lot of carbon out there. You don't have a lot of heavy minerals, so you've got no radioactivity in Titan. Therefore, there's nothing in there that can really warm it up. So you've got these really super cold temperatures. But again, you've got so much more carbon. It really shows the early solar system was split up into heavy stuff inward and the light stuff out there. So much more water and carbon that you have many more of these organic molecules that are really pretty rare on the Earth compared to out there.
If Titan happened to have been as close as planet Earth, what kind of life do you think it might have?
Well, you certainly wouldn't have all the methane lakes, and you wouldn't have these really strange petroleum seas and these weird, really strange snowflakes of carbon dioxide and snowflakes of methane falling into these lakes. It would be much warmer, and because it would be warmer, just like gasoline when it's warmed, it evaporates out. You would have lost a lot of these really light organics. The stuff that would have been left behind would have been sort of much more sludgy. But again, had it formed closer to the sun, it would have had a wholly different distribution of the types of elements. It would have been a lot more of the heavy stuff, a lot of the irons, and a lot of even the uraniums that we have.
And they don't have dead dinosaurs on that little moon, huh?
They don't. But here's the coolest experiment that a couple of people have suggested. You know what we ought to do is go around Europa with a spaceship that has nets on it and see if we could scoop up any fish in orbit. Now, that sounds like a joke.
What do you mean, fish in orbit?
Yeah, fish in orbit, because you've got the possibility. You've got all kinds of asteroids blasting holes in that ice cover and throwing into space huge quantities of Europa ocean.
Huh.
And 20 years ago, it was suggested by actually a very famous physicist that, well, there's a possibility. Because if there's fish there, they would have definitely been splashed into orbit. And you just sit around there with a spaceship with a net, you can catch the fish frozen, of course.
And I guess they never would have decomposed because they
would have been frozen. No, of course, they'd still be there. I mean, it just sounds like a joke, but it's not. I mean, very well, if there were fish in there, they would be in orbit.
Restaurants would love that. Flash frozen
there
fish.
There you go.
say that really fast. Flash frozen fish. Can you say that?
I'm not going to, not at this time of night.
Let's go back to the phone. Scott, truck driving in Pennsylvania. Hi, Scotty. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How's everything?
Good.
I called you a couple of years ago and gave you my theory, which doesn't differ all that much from Peter's theory. Adam and Eve were sent down here from Mars as a advance party, and their purpose was to build the Great Pyramid. Now, back in them days, the Earth, I think, was spinning a lot faster, which gives you the reason for people in the Bible having ages, 10 times more than what we live now.
Mm-hmm.
All right. When they built the Great Pyramid, there was another pyramid on Mars being built simultaneously, and when the two met, the Earth stopped, completely stopped, which made the crust fold and created the mountains and all that stuff. And on Mars, when Mars stopped, it created a great funnel with all the water and everything. And people got into their little capsules and floated through the water to Earth. When the water from Mars hit Earth, well, it created Mariana's Trench. And, of course, there's one spot deeper in Mariana's Trench that's the point of impact. And the rest of it's, the way it flowed. And that, of course, is the time of the Great Flood. And when...
Huh. Yeah, you're right.
When the water hit the Earth, it started the Earth moving again, and it gave us the 1,000 mile an hour rotation we got right now, and that's my theory.
Peter, let's get your reaction to Scott's theory.
Well, look, this is so cool. I think you should write it up. Now, the beauty of the world today is that we have the internet, and everybody and anybody can now put out ideas, fascinating ideas. Whereas in the past, we had these mainstream media. You couldn't get a scientific paper published unless it had all the referees. And we have this freedom. I mean, that's such a cool set of ideas. You should write it up, start a blog, and send it out there and see what happens. You might actually find a following who totally agree with you. I mean, go for it. This is the beauty of the world today.
That's
go for
true.
It. Write it up.
Okay, next up we go to Lindy in Tangent, Oregon, west of the Rockies. Hi, Lindy.
Hey.
Good to have you.
I like that guy's theory. And I just wanted to ask you about, I get nervous, because you're talking about aliens and sledding. And then I wanted to ask about what the scientists what I like scientists, at what he thinks about the water in the moon.
Okay.
And yeah, and cool, you know how it? The in that movie AI and the beginning where it shows the awesome the special effects that shows Manhattan covered in water.
Yes.
Oh, that was the coolest scene. I just when I was writing my book, I went back and looked at that again. You know, that could have been one of Spielberg's best movies ever if he hadn't put in that really schlocky ending. And then it got just a little too drippy. But just if they would have ended it with the kids.
Well, what was interesting though?
A little sappy.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was.
What was interesting though was they made the mother out of the hair. They brought her back from the hair.
Yeah.
They cloned her or whatever, and I thought that was kind of interesting how the aliens did that. And you're talking about life forms and like say some hair, you know, got on the moon or something from somebody and they left their hair there. Could they eventually grow into?
Well, sure. Absolutely.
I'll tell you something analogous here. Is I've got a friend who tracks poaching of ivory tusks, and he has figured out a way to get entire DNA out of a tusk. You know, it used to be you needed blood or something. He's getting it out of the hard parts. But even cooler, and I'm sorry to assault your viewers like this, he figured out another way to get DNA out of whales. He took a bunch of drug-sniffing dogs, and he taught them how to sniff whale poop. This is a true story.
Wow.
So we have all the killer whales in Puget Sound. He puts the dogs on the front, and they bark left or right, and they scoop up the poop, and the poop has the DNA of the whales. So he's been able to census all the whales of Puget Sound because poop has DNA in it. You never know where you're going to find that stuff. Why not a hair?
That's very interesting.
Yeah, you should see these dogs.
Not very appetizing, but very interesting.
Oh, come on. You know, dogs are dogs. They love to roll in dead salmon. They don't care.
Chad's in Dallas, and he's on the air. Hi, Chad. Go ahead.
Hey, George and Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Peter, I'm no scientist, but I wanted to get your thoughts on something. I don't remember whether you said it was bacteria or what it was, but basically the crux of it is over the course of so many billions of years, it can turn into crystals and then turn into us, basically. My question is, if you put the pieces of a watch in a bag and shook it up for trillions and trillions of years, it would never become a watch because it requires an intelligent being and a creator to create the watch and take those pieces and create something. So for me, the idea of a universe apart from intelligent design and a creator, it's unfathomable. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, this is a famous analogy, by the way, called The Blind Watchmaker, that Richard Dawkins wrote a whole book with that title alone. It's kind of, if you start thinking about time, so let's say, yeah, you put it in a bag and you shake it for like a year or two. That's quite a long time. What if you shook it for like a billion years? Who's to say that in all that time, just sheer chance, you couldn't put it together? I mean, you can't say that it wouldn't happen over the long periods of time. You know, I get your drift. There's just so many things that seem incomprehensible. On the other hand, imagine having to sit down and make a TV set. I have no idea how a TV set works. There's no way in the world I would know how to manufacture the glass and make the metal and get all the rare earths and make the darn thing get together, let alone build all the electricity. And yet all that stuff eventually was built, extremely complicated piece by piece by piece. I mean, complication takes place, but it takes time.
It sure does. Augusta, Georgia, we go. Bill, let's go. Go ahead.
Annie Jacobson's book on Area 51, she makes an astounding claim in there. She's got an inside source that says that the Roswell crash in 1947 was the result of Stalin's and Joseph Mengele sending over a couple of child-sized aviators that were genetically altered to look like Martians, the big head.
To scare us.
To scare us. Genetic alterations wasn't possible in 1947, was it? And not to this degree where you could create a human being that would look like a Martian. No nose, big eyes, big head, small frame.
How far advanced were the Germans with that kind of genetic manipulation, Peter?
Look, we couldn't even do that now. This is just so far beyond the possibility of science at that level at that time. DNA hadn't even been discovered in 1947. You couldn't manipulate something you didn't know existed. or didn't exist.
So you don't think they had it?
No, I think your listener, you're absolutely correct. It's just at that time, it was way too primitive to have that level of sophistication. Again, it would just be almost impossible to do that today for modern-day methods, and we're so far advanced over 47.
Let's go back to Houston, Texas we are. Hi, Heather, go ahead.
Hi, this is a great show, I wanted to say. Also, I've been studying with a professor in the past when I was in grad school, and one of the classes I took, she taught about astrophysics and biology in the universe, and she studied at Oxford. And I was wondering if you'd heard about homo chirality as a signature of life in space, because almost all amino acids and proteins are left-handed, and they're looking for left-handed signatures in space because most everything in space is right-handed.
Yeah,
heard about it.
Indeed, we have, and that's a very interesting field of study, and it's still pretty unexplained why you would have all this left-handedness. The other deal is when you have naturally occurring molecules, they'll be about 50-50, but when you start getting all in one direction, you know there had to be some other properties involved. And we're looking over and over for signatures of life, and this is certainly one that shows up and that people are just following. That sounds like it would have been a really fun class.
All right, thanks. Jason in Fredonia, Arizona, first-time caller. We'll get you in here. Hi, Jason.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen.
You too.
I have a theory that might explain why people lived so long back in biblical days.
All right.
And where all the water came from. What if there was a sphere of water that was around the earth that somehow protected people, UV rays, they lived longer, and then when it flooded, somehow melted, which would explain the shortening of years.
So maybe like a huge ring of water all around the planet.
Sure.
What do you
sure.
think about that, Peter?
Certainly you see rings around the sun where there's lots and lots of ice crystals. But I'm kind of going back. I'm really not convinced that people actually did live longer back in those days. And if you take just a pure scientific look at it, we know that people today, by the time you hit 100 years old, every part of your body is broken down. And unless there is some big genetic shift over the last few thousand years where we radically changed all the genes that deal with aging, it just seems pretty far-fetched to me that, at least in a scientific sense, people could have lived 800 years. I can't buy it.
I know. They must have been playing around with numbers then, huh?
Well, it's just, it's allegory as far as I can tell, and I don't want to take anybody's sense or belief away from them, but it's just, as a scientist sitting here, I can just think of a whole bunch of reasons just based on genetics why you couldn't have anybody living even 150 years.
Let's go to Dave in Navarre, Florida. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. I was wondering what your speaker might, if he's seen Ben Stein's documentary, Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. I'm a fundamentalist Christian, pretty new believer, but it's a fascinating documentary, and it really talks about the hostility that science has towards intelligent design. And I was wondering what you might think about intelligent design, and I'll hang up. Thank you.
You got it. It's all yours, Peter.
Well, I think a lot of the hostility actually came from Ben in that as well. I mean, he certainly took a point of view.
Bueller.
And
Bueller.
Went with it. Well, he
Bueller.
Did. I've debated intelligence design people, and I just find that it's very hard to debate them, that they're not going to take criticism well. So it generally falls down to the name-calling.
All right, let's take one or two more. San Francisco, we go. Mike, let's get you in. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. Peter, I've gone to the library and wanted to check out all your books, but they wouldn't let me. You've written a plethora of them, and they're great. I wanted to ask about the BP oil spill, if that might have enough chemistry to alter the biology, and if it's also altering the weather, what with the die-off, the heat rising from methane and the deterioration of dead animals from dolphins to plankton. if that might be causing some of this weird weather, which could also have an effect on the biology. Thanks for all your work, man.
Well, thanks, but man, great question. You know, two of my funnest shows ever were on the oil spill on Coast to Coast last year. I had more interaction. That was great. You know, what's really spooking me, I don't understand all these tornadoes. This has been such a shocking, horrible, tragic year. We have to believe that there's a radical change in the weather. Come on, this is not normal stuff.
And not even halfway through yet either.
I know. I mean, this is just, it's so horrid what is going on and the loss of life and how anybody could say that we're not seeing a rapid change in weather. The only thing you can really blame it on now is we had La Nina, but the heat increase that's going on in the oceans is manifesting itself. More water is going to the atmosphere, and more water in the atmosphere causes more of these crazy storm cycles. I think it's a view of the near future, and it's scaring me to death.
Peter, your works, your books, where are they available? Amazon.com, no doubt?
Oh, yeah.
And which
libraries.
And the one
I kind of feel like Abby Hoffman, go steal that book.
Go steal it. And what's the one you're working on now that you're looking for a publisher?
Actually, I'm doing a book called A New History of Life. But if any of your readers are interested, I've just written my first novel. It's about mass extinctions in the Permian, and it's a murder mystery. It takes place where the biggest, best fossil ever found disappears. But in the course of this, I discovered that much of the world's uranium was produced into a layer by the biggest mass extinction on Earth. This is a true story. So I've written a novel around it. Any of your listeners want it, send me an email. I'm easily found, Peter Ward, University of Washington. I'll send you a PDF tonight.
You got it. Thanks, Peter. Appreciate you being on the program. Peter Ward, up next with our split show, Nurse Joyce Riley joins us. Gather around the radio. I don't want you to miss this story.